My name's Rusty Kelly. I'm from Park Hill in Denver, Colorado, District 1112. And I know you don't care about that, but one of the many good extra benefits that I've gotten from being in this program for a lot of years is that now I know who I am and where I'm coming from, and I like to start by saying that. I got to Al-Anon the way all the Al-Anons in this room got here. I got here because I loved an alcoholic. And I was a little luckier than most of the Al-Anons, because I loved two of them. And I fell in love with both of them at the same day, the same place, and the same time. They were my twin sons, and I fell in love with them in the delivery room. They were average, normal little kids. They didn't have any little A branded on their hides anywhere to tell me that they were alcoholics. That's how I know that God loves alcoholics, because if you came marked, even your mothers would not take you home if they knew what you were in for. By the time the twins were born, I was 22 years old. I already had a child who was not yet 10 months old, and I was on my second marriage. Now, I want you to know that I was sane and nothing was wrong with me at that point, but things were moving a little fast. By the time I was 29 years old, I had six children, six boys. The oldest was 8, and I was a little busy. I don't know whether I was happy or not happy, because I never had time to check on that. I wiped noses, and I washed socks, and I cleaned bedrooms, and I listened to homework, and I didn't have a lot of spare time for introspection and asking myself any great philosophical questions. The second marriage, this marriage that produced these children, was not a wonderful marriage to start with. My husband was a man who never drank in his life and had an alcoholic personality, came from an alcoholic family. His father was a town drunk in a real big town. His brothers were not slouches in the alcoholic business, but his mother had always told him that he would be a good person if he didn't drink. So he didn't drink. He just behaved like a drunk. But I didn't know how drunks behaved at that point in my life. I knew absolutely nothing about alcoholism. I'd grown up in a household where everybody drank and nobody abused alcohol, and I didn't know anything about an alcoholic personality or even alcoholic abuse or anything to do with that. In my family, wine was served with meals, and if it was a hot day and you wanted a beer, you had one, and if it was a cold night and you wanted a brandy, you had one. And it had nothing to do with some arbitrary age when you would be old enough to drink. And it had nothing to do with any moral factors. You just had to drink if you wanted to drink. It was no big deal. It saved me going to Woodsy's when I was a teenager. Just saved me a whole lot of trouble, because I could have a drink at home and I didn't have to get bitten by all those mosquitoes and get beer in my socks and all the rest of that stuff that folks were doing in Woodsy's. So I thought I knew a lot about alcohol. Until I moved to New Mexico, I really thought I knew a lot about alcohol. I didn't know anything about it. And nobody told me that altitude made a difference. So one time when we were going up in the mountains, when I was new there, I went with this, the rest of the people had gone earlier, but I'd had to work a day shift on Saturday, so I was going up late. I went up with this man that I thought drank a lot. What do I know about alcoholism? And my theory was, I don't want to drive over that dirt road pass with this man if he's been drinking, so I'll tell him to stop at the bar on the way up to the top of the pass, and I'll get him one more drink, and he'll pass out, and I can drive over the pass. You know the ending to that. You know who drove over the pass, and you know who passed out. He did his homework every day, and I was a little out of condition for this sort of thing. It took me another 2 years to remember what it was like over that pass. It was scary. That's what it was like. One of the ways my husband dealt with life, his father had been a very abusive alcoholic, and it is no exaggeration to say that the children were knocked down, knocked across the floor, had their teeth rearranged for doing dreadful things like interrupting when he was reading the paper and talking when they should have been listening and things like that. And so my husband was determined that there would not be violence in his family, and giving full credit where credit is due, there was not. He was not a man who was violent against either me or his children. But what he did do was go to his room a lot. That's probably why we had six kids in 8 years. But he didn't cope with any of this. He would say, I have to get up and go to work in the morning, so you have to take care of it. And I took care of everything. And I disciplined my children, and I brought them up right. I had kids whose allowance was suspended up through their first Social Security payment. Kids who were sent to bed without supper, including their wedding nights. We had basically in my house one rule, and that rule was don't mess with Mama. And Mama was in charge of things. And the kids very seldom messed with Mama until the twins were old enough. Now, we lived in a town called Springer, New Mexico. I don't know if you're at all familiar with New Mexico and small towns there, but Spring is one of those towns that fits in between yield ahead and resume speed, and you've got the whole town right in there. It has two grocery stores and four bars and 12 churches. And you know those kind of towns. They're the same in rural America everywhere. And we lived, it was my bright idea. I thought that we were going to buy the weekly newspaper when my husband retired from the service, and we were going to get rich, and it was going to be wonderful. And besides, it was going to be such a wonderful environment. And in the back of my mind, since the marriage was on its way down the tubes anyway, I thought, you know, I'll get away from my folks and his folks, and we won't have anybody interfering with anything. And it will make everything wonderful. So we moved there, and I wrote the paper, and my husband printed the paper, and the kids sold the paper on the street corner, and we went bankrupt anyway. In that town, there isn't a lot to do. There's one movie theater in town, and three nights a week it has a Spanish feature, so there's not much to do. And the thing that everybody in that town, well, not the only thing, there are some things that I was glad that the teenagers weren't really getting into that were being done in that town. But one of the main things that people did and kids did was drink in the local bars. In New Mexico at that time, and this is some time ago, the only rule for what you could, you know, the only alcoholic control law was that anybody could get a drink, regardless of age. But an adult had to be with children who were drinking and say that I will take responsibility for this child, give him a drink, in which case the bartender served him. Well, the kids were not stupid. They got the little money from selling the newspaper, and they would say, I'll buy you a drink if you'll buy me one. And it didn't take them long. The first time they ever went out drinking, they were delivered like cordwood or milk bottles and placed on the front porch, and you dragged them in and sobered them up and read them the Riot Act. But you see, their drinking was in some ways a real relief for me because I thought I knew how to cope with drinking. And it took my eyes off myself and what was wrong with my own life and what was wrong with the marriage and what was wrong inside me and let me concentrate on sobering up a couple of alcoholics. I had a clutch of them, you know. Some people only have one to sober up. One of the ways I was going to do this was to teach them to drink. Now, on this program, we don't give advice, but I strongly suggest that you don't try to teach alcoholics to drink. It will cause you bankruptcy faster than buying rural newspapers. I taught them to drink properly, as I had been taught to drink, and that white wine goes with fish and red wine goes with red meat. And they drank wine without fish and with fish and with meat and without meat, and they had absolutely no respect for all the rules of drinking that I had always been taught. And when I did the household accounts and discovered that we'd spent $5.95 for fish and $52 for white wine, you can see that that this is not going to work out. I'm short, but I'm not stupid. So I moved on to my next cure, which was to teach them to drink good stuff. And you see, I was going to teach them to appreciate the taste of good alcohol. So I bought stuff like Courvoisier, and you put Courvoisier and you light a candle to keep it warm in the glass, and it cost $22 for a pint. And I thought that surely if you learned to drink that, you couldn't drink much on an allowance, and they would learn to like good stuff, and it would keep them sober because they couldn't afford much. So I bought a bottle of Courvoisier, and I taught them that you just take a little sip and you let it roll around on the back of your tongue. And in a day or so, they'd say, Ma, we've been trying to roll this on the back of our tongue, and it's all gone, and could we get another bottle and practice rolling it on the back of our tongues again? And I began to see that perhaps I did not know the solvent cure for, I didn't know alcoholism, but for drinking too much. At about that time, they were still teenagers. We moved up to Denver, and then I had a fine excuse for them because there were more kids in the high school alone that they attended. There were probably more kids in their class than there were in the population of the town we left, so of course they needed to drink a little because they were lost and lonesome in the big city. And so they didn't need an excuse for the first 3 weeks. And by that time the first 3 weeks were over, I was already mad with them and telling them how to drink, what to drink, where to drink, and when to drink. The difference between the twins is that one was a binge drinker and one was a daily drinker. It's sometimes days sort of blurred in together. And, you know, the binge drinkers are hard to live with, but they have some advantages because I always thought I got the binge drinker cured. It was so long between binges. And so I would say to his brother, now look, you know, your brother's okay. He's learned to drink and drink like a gentleman, and why can't you? At about which time the binge drinker would disappear for 3 days and his friends would bring him home on a shingle and the whole good lesson that I'd learned and taught was down the drain. When they were seniors in high school, they were still drinking, and I said, you can bring home your enlistment papers or passing grades. It's hard to get passing grades, as you said, and drink a lot. And they had their priorities firmly in mind. They drank. They didn't care about passing grades. So they brought home their enlistment papers and went into the service. And I thought they were cured. You can't drink in boot camp. I grew up in the service, and I thought that's where you learn to drink. I grew up as part of a service family. I thought you learned to drink in the service, and they would. It's sort of like the service will make a man out of you. Well, maybe it will if you were going to be one anyway. But if you were going to be a drunk, it's no slouch at helping you into being a drunk either. One of the twins, the binge drinker, served out his enlistment and got an honorable discharge. The other twin was in Vietnam, was drinking heavily, and was going to be sent home because he was too drunk to be a drunken sailor. And that's pretty drunk, and it was pretty scary for me. When he tells his story now, he's had a lot of sobriety in AA. When he tells his story, he says he's an arrested alcoholic, and he bets he's been arrested more times than anybody in the room. And that's probably true, because when he was in NAM, they used to keep his cell for him. Whenever they gave him leave, they made sure that they kept his cell so they could, he was only a little kid, so they could tuck him back in his bed when they dragged him home, and the next day he got captain's mast, and then they thought he was a big boy. And he had the stripes on his sleeve with snaps, because they pulled them off so often. This time they were tired of playing and they were sending him home, and I was panic-stricken, terrified. I didn't know what to do about having him come home. So I made a deal with God. Now, I didn't believe in God, but I made a deal with God just the same. Whoever this sort of a black cloud person out there was that kept raining on my parade was my version of God, and I made the deal with him that if he would let Bernie die overseas, I would always tell his brothers that he was a wonderful person. I would make him a hero. I would never tell anybody that he was a drunk. And I would use the insurance money to send all his brothers through college and never spend any of it on myself. God heard my prayer and he answered it. He said no. And so I was stuck with a drunk coming home, and I did what any mother would do. I appealed to a congressman. My husband had been service before retirement. My father was service. And so I knew people all over the country, and I wrote to everybody I knew and told them to write to their congressman, and I wrote to mine, and I wrote to any congressman I ever heard of. And I got back long letters and highly fashionable, wonderful, political words, 2.5 pages, double-spaced, that said, forget it, lady, but very politely. Vote for me anyway. So, of course, I was the colonel's daughter, and I was not accustomed to dealing with underlings, so I conceived a great idea. I called the president. It's not difficult, as you may think, to call the president. It's a listed number. The White House is a listed number. And the operator will give it to you, and you just dial it the way you dial J.C. Penney's or anybody else you want to dial. But it's a strange thing about the White House. Now, who would think that anybody, they live in the White House, that's their home. Who would think you would have a switchboard in your house? They have a switchboard there, and the operator on that switchboard is cold. And you cannot get by that woman no matter what you say, and they have cloned her, and her clones are on all the other shifts. There is no way that you can get the president. The only other thing I knew about alcoholism was a little thing I had read in a magazine that said a new alcoholic is like a new baby. It can't be left alone. And a little thing in the Aurora, Colorado newspaper that said, do you have a drinking problem? Call such and such a number. Well, I worked 3 to 11. My husband worked 7 to 3. So I needed somebody so he wouldn't be alone 11 to 7. And I called the number. I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, I have a drinking problem and he'll be home Saturday. And I want you to go to the airport with me and meet him and take care of him. And the man who answered the phone said, we don't do that. Oh, well, he said, did he ask you to call? And I said, well, no, of course he didn't ask me to call. He's being shipped home. You have to understand, he's too drunk to be a drunken sailor, and they're shipping him home, and he wants to keep drinking, and you've got to sort of sneak up on him and catch him at the airport and get him to wherever you take him. And he said, we don't do that either. I said, what kind of a jam am I in here? What kind of a life is this? You can't get hold of the president in a democracy where the government is supposed to be available to you. You can get hold of Alcoholics Anonymous, but they don't do anything you ask them to. What am I going to do now? But the man on the phone said, maybe you're sick. So yes, exactly. So he also said, I don't think I can help you, but perhaps you could talk to my wife. So I thought, this is reasonable. This man thinks I'm drunk. I could hear myself rambling on and talking away, and I thought, it's reasonable. He thinks I'm drunk. All the people who ever call him are drunks. He thinks I'm drunk. And he doesn't want to come out here and search me to get my bottle. He's a man. I'm a woman. He's going to send his wife, of course. And I visualized a car or a pickup truck coming out with a sign on the back somewhere that said Alcoholics Anonymous Rescue Squad and parking across the street while the wife came in and searched me for my bottle and did whatever alcoholics do with drunks. So, but I did say that I would call her. And I always, you know, in the back of my mind is the idea that if she's really obnoxious about this, I'll give her the wrong address and she'll never find me. So I called her, and it was the first time that I had ever talked about anything. The man sort of blew me away because he answered the phone and he said, hello, my name is Dick and I'm an alcoholic. And I always thought if you were an alcoholic, you certainly would never tell anybody, particularly on the phone. So I was a little shaken to begin with. And she also thought I might be sick. But I talked to her, and I had never talked to anyone about any problem in my family. I was brought up that you didn't do that you didn't burden other people with your problems, that you kept them to yourself and you solved them yourself, and you didn't take them to other people. So I was sort of amazed to hear myself talking and talking and talking to this lady and saying, you know, I really love him, but he's a terrible drunk and I don't know what to do with him. And I didn't know the difference between a garden variety drunk and an alcoholic, and I thought I was offending her by saying he was a drunk when she thought he was something with a real title like an alcoholic. And I talked to that woman for so long that it kind of bothered me, and she said I should go to meetings. And I felt guilty for tying up her time for so long, so I said, okay, I'll go to a meeting. And I thought, they probably gave her some kind of an award for bringing in the most people this year. And she should be able to get that because I'd used up so much of her time. And I talked to my husband about it and said, now, I don't think we should spend more than $200 learning how to cure him of alcoholism. And I'm out of school for the summer, and I can't tie up any more than the summer on this course. If it's more than 1 year, I can't take it. But we agreed that I would go, and then I called her back and said, you know, it looks like rain, and I don't think I can go out. And she said, don't worry about it, I'm coming by and get you. So I went to the first Al-Anon meeting that I had ever been to, and it was wonderful. We worry a lot on the program these days. I hear many people talking about it. What are we saying? Are we offending newcomers? And is this meeting geared properly to newcomers? As far as I know, that meeting may have been conducted in Swahili. I don't have any idea what it was about, but it was the first place I'd ever been in my life where I felt loved. I walked into that room, and nobody said, as soon as we get you fixed, we'll love you. They said, sit down, have a cup of coffee, we'll all talk to you later. They'd arranged for some other mothers of alcoholics to be there because I had been sure it would only be wives and that they were waiting for mother. Wives get them all grown up so they shouldn't feel guilty about their drinking. Only mothers should feel guilty because we warped the little demons when they were young. So I figured there were probably a bunch of wives there waiting to tell me what I'd done wrong. And they didn't. And to me, that was love. I have never gone into any room in more terror than I went into that one. But I was loved there, and I went back for that reason and that reason alone. And somewhere, a week, a month, 2 months into the program, somebody started talking about steps, and they gave me a copy. And I took them home, and I read them, and I thought they were wonderful. I was very impressed with those steps, and I went back to the next meeting and said, these steps are wonderful. How will I get him to do them? And they said, it doesn't work like that. You have to do them. So I went home and read them again, and I didn't think many of them applied to me, and I went back and said, if I do these, how long after I finish will he get sober? And they said, no, it doesn't work like that either. And why don't you just come to some meetings and keep quiet and see if something will get in. And just read and study a little. And some lady appointed herself my sponsor, and she used to call every day or every other day. And that lady was just mean. And she'd call and say, how are you? Don't tell me. I know how you are. What are you doing? Do the dishes. Do a step. Come to a meeting. Now we don't give a lot of orders, but she gave me a lot, and I needed them. I really needed them. I needed to be told my idea of organized at that point was, you know, I ran in the kitchen and I washed one dish, and then I went in the bedroom and I changed one pillowcase, and then I ran back and washed another dish, and then I fed the dog. And my whole life was just in a jumble until I went to work. And when I went to work, I was Mrs. Cool, because that was what I did. I was wonderful at work. I told everybody I was wonderful, and I listened for them to tell me back. Most of the time it was just the wind blowing my breath back in my face, but I thought they were saying I was wonderful. And I really was very good at my job. I still am. I went back and said, okay, so I'll do some of these steps. Because I had already heard you say that this program was about God as you understood him. And the other thing that I heard you say was take what you want and leave the rest. Well, I didn't understand God, so I left everything that was about God. If you're looking for a easier, softer way, that reduces the steps to 5, and it's an easier, softer way. It doesn't work, but it's an easy, soft way. In the meantime, the alcoholic came home, and we, for once, my husband and I agreed on something, and we said, you can go to AA and stay sober and stay here, but if you drink, you can't stay here, and you must go to AA. And he did go to AA, and I went with him. I was off work because I had a back injury, so I got to go to lots of meetings. The state of Colorado is not so foolish as to have given him a driver's license. I've seen him sober, and I still don't see why they gave him a driver's license. I went to meetings with him, and I sat beside him, and I gave him the old elbow in the ribs bit and said, did you hear that? And don't you think that applies to you? Don't you think our lives would be better if you applied that? And then I drove home with him, and I explained to him all the fine points of the program and all the little nuances and other things that he may have missed in his alcoholic mind. And he got sober anyway. It had nothing whatever to do with me. It was God's work. And I began to see that it really didn't have anything to do with me, because he was sober, and besides sober, he was, if not well, certainly better. And I was not better. So I went back and found a sponsor. I picked out a bunch of sponsors for him before he came home when I first called Alcoholics Anonymous, and he fired a bunch of them, and a bunch of them quit, and he got some inappropriate sponsors, and it was working. So I got me an inappropriate sponsor, and I went to her and said, you have to show me how to do this, because I don't know how to do it, and he's getting well, and it makes me mad that he's well when I'm so much smarter than he is and I'm sick. So we began to work on trying to do some steps. In the meantime, the other alcoholic had, I don't mean to be offensive, but he had gotten a religious cult in California, which prevented everything, prohibited everything that looked like it was either fun or cost money, and deviated it from the treasury of the cult. So he was sober at that point. It kept him sober about the same length of time that binge drinkers usually stay sober. But it gave him a good place to go and repent when he finished the binge. And he did that quite often. But then after a while, he decided that he would only drink a little wine, because it says in the Bible that a little wine is good for your stomach. He had such a healthy stomach, you couldn't believe it. He bled all the time, but basically it was real healthy. And he went from a little white wine. You know, you don't want to have a color prejudice. If you're going to drink white wine, you might as well drink Jack Daniel's Black. And he was up to about a quart a day at the point that he moved to Colorado. So that was much later, after Bernie'd been sober some time, and after I'd been on this program, and after I'd done some steps, and after my sponsor had said, steps are fine, they'll get you well, and if you want to stay well, you've got to do service work and get out and get busy and do things. And I had begun to do that. I wish that I could tell you that I did the steps, and that I've been in Al-Anon now a long time, and that nothing bad ever happened to me after I finished the steps, and that I'm just held in the palm of God's hand, and this is an Al-Anon story, and it's a true story, and so that isn't true. On the twins' 13th birthday, I finally had a little girl. All the rest of the children were little boys. In some way, in my mind, she was a reaffirmation that there are good things in the world, and that it wasn't all as bad as it seemed to me where I was, and that things would be good. She was a pretty little girl and a smart little girl. When she was only 9, she was a dancer soloist with the Denver Symphony. When she was still about 15, professional ballet companies were producing her choreography. When she was 16, she went to the police in the town where we lived and had her father arrested for rape, said she had been raped on a regular basis, and she was about 8 years old. I was called by the police, went to the police station, and the police kept me there because I had said, I'm going to kill him. And they kept me talking, quote, in the police station while they went to the house and sneaked him out the back door, put him in jail where he was safe from me, because I would really have killed that man. I worked with that. This program is wonderful. It's 3 o'clock in the morning, and I'm calling an Al-Anon whose AA husband answers at 3 o'clock in the morning and does not say, for crying out tears, it's 3 o'clock. He said, are you okay to drive the car, or shall I come get you? I'll put the garage lights on. This is your home till you don't need it here anymore. So I went to them and stayed with them and tried to work steps for a few days. And you know how AAs are. They read you the big book. No matter what happens, they read you the big book. Somewhere about page 560 in the big book, it says that if you want to get over a resentment, you have to pray for the person against whom you have the resentment. So I went back to my home determined that I was going to pray for that man. And I knelt, and I bent my head, and I said, God damn him. And I'm sorry if you find that offensive. It's not meant to be, and it's not meant for shock value. I never said a more sincere prayer in my life. That's what I wanted. That's what I meant when I said it. It took me more than months of trying to pray for him before I was ever able to do that. And I finally was able to say his name and say, bless him. And that wasn't enough. I had to say, I ask for him every good thing that I can ask for myself. And if you had not held my hands through all of that, I never would have gotten that done. Shortly after we were divorced, I filed it as soon as this was known to me. He developed cancer. I was able to take that man with your help when he was dying of cancer to see his son in California and bring him home because he was too ill to fly alone. And bring him home only 5 days before his death. I was able to do that knowing I would never love that I should love each other, but knowing that I could love him as a fellow child of God and a sufferer from a terrible disease. And he was able to die as I had asked for God to give him, with not that I have so much power that I manipulate God, but I had asked that he have the affection and respect of his children, and he was able to die with that affection and respect. And you helped me, and you made it possible for me to be able to do that. He was dead about 4 months when my youngest son, who was not an alcoholic and was not into drugs, and whom some of you knew he was or have seen, he was a very successful young man on the Johnny Carson show a couple of times. He sat in his truck not very far from his house, put the gun to his head and pulled the trigger, and died instantly. I came back from that with an anger against God that is not even expressible. I had come in this program in a complete cycle from the day I came in and said, there is no God and he's mad with me, to the point where I was saying, there is a God and I am mad with him. There were people in this program who came to me from all over the state of Colorado and some other places and worked with me and helped me through that and helped me. Someone told me that I should do a 4-step on God and my relationship to him. And I tried to do that. I didn't find out a lot about God. I guess you just can't take even God's inventory. But I found out a lot about me. And I found out that when I was a little girl, the God of my understanding had been Daddy and Grandpa. And I had gotten along with them by being a good girl and smiling a lot, because they liked girls who smiled, and being fine, nice, good for them. And they protected me from all evil. And that was the kind of God that I had made in my mind, that I would manipulate him by being good, and he would protect me and no evil would ever befall me. And that isn't the way it works, and that isn't the way my God has come to be since that day. And I have been able, with this program and your help and the help of the Big Book and all those alcoholics who read it to me and all the alcoholics and Al-Anons who called and said, do this and do that and we love you and God loves you and you will get through this. I have been able to get through that. The corollary to that story, the next chapter of that, is that the first day of my vacation this year, I was in Ohio in my sister's house. I got a phone call, and a second son had done exactly the same thing. I came home and called my little red-headed sponsor and said, you and I have got to talk about the third step, because I'm sick of turning my life over to the care of God and having him take my children. And my little sponsor said, he didn't take your children, he received your children. And that has made all the difference to me that I have needed to have made. I had the privilege of being the camp nurse for the Alateens in Rocky Mountain this year. And they have a slogan, I don't know whether it belongs to them or whether it belongs to the camp, but it's a big slogan over the door. And it says, the time to be happy is now. The place to be happy is here. And I have been able to apply that to my Al-Anon life. I wish I'd come here from Denver to give you some wonderful insights and tell you a wonderful way to work this program, or give you insights into the steps that you've never known before, and do something that would greatly move you, and I can't do any of those things. I can only tell you that for me, this program works. I came here without a God, and I came here without a friend, and I have both in the program, and I thank the program for God and God for the program.
Thank you, Rusty.